The Washington Post reported that nearly 20,000 mercenaries are fighting in Ukraine. When you put together with the information that Putin gave us during that interview that he was talking about mercenaries in Ukraine, do you think this number is precise?
There are definitely, there is a significant number of those mercenaries. Today in RIA News, which is a very reputable Russian media organization, and it was, of course, reported across the number of the major news outlets, is the fact that Russian officials already openly going on record talking about primarily American mercenaries, so-called, which are not mercenaries. They are not volunteers. They are professional military, which go there undercover, under legend. They fly aircraft, obviously, which are being shut down. They man their air defense complexes, and most of the ground troops which are present there, they are barrier troops. They are primarily shooting into the backs of the Ukrainian armed forces who want to retreat or who, for example, want to surrender. And they already characterize their combat capabilities, saying that, well, they are well trained, but they really buckle under the serious pressure, which is, of course, a very indicative and very important, how to put it, note on a Russian part. So, yeah, they know how to shoot into backs of retreating troops. But I don't think so. They operate openly in any kind of formation on the front line. And again, we know that number of them have been taken prisoners by Russia. So whatever is happening now behind curtain, so to speak, between Russians and Americans in terms of whatever they exchange or return, I don't know. But we already have the good characterization of them.
Instagram has started blocking videos of an Abrams that is being hit and burning down. When you look at the Abrams and compare it with the German, with the tanks coming from the United Kingdom, they didn't do this for those tanks, and they're doing this for Abrams.
Because it's all American military mythology. American military history of the end of the 20th century, well, actually the 20th century, and especially the start of the 21st, is confabulated. That means what? It was imagined. It's most of it, even which in no way diminishes their heroism and dedication, for example, of American GIs during the World War II, and their, some really outstanding American generals, not George Patton, but others, actually. And but it's, they like to pretend that they defeated Hitler. Well, in reality, of course, they were dealing with the basically washout troops, which haven't been in nothing in comparison to the Wehrmacht, for example, circa 1941, 1942, and even 1943. So it was confabulated, and the question now is that the part of this mythology, obviously, was built around another war, which militarily wasn't that consequential. We're talking about the First Gulf War, and it was spun so much by propaganda. So the way it goes, and they don't like to be humiliated publicly. Because it's, but, professionals already know the real score, honestly. United States Army is absolutely not what they tried to portray them be. And the latest information, especially about those so-called volunteers, that they really buckle under the pressure in the real war, So, and yeah, I mean, what's the point for them to die there for whatever, Ukraine? Sure. They have no real attachment there. And obviously from the moral position of the troops there, it's do they even believe in the mission? I doubt it. I don't think so.
When you look at this conflict right now, we have been in this conflict 19 months, 20 months. How prepared was the West? How prepared was Russia? How do you compare them?
Russia was prepared, and the Russians started to prepare actually since 2007, since Vladimir Putin's famous Munich speech, and then, of course, wiping out the floor with the Georgian army, the first American proxy, which have been defeated, and actually quite disastrously for Georgia, as we know. But Russia was preparing. It was the set of the reforms. It was the set of the political and economic reforms, and especially of the Russian state returning back the control to the strategic resources. And this process continues as we speak. So Russia was prepared. The West, as I already stated, there are no competent people in the Western elites. Haven't been there for like for the last 20 years at least. We finally get this crop of those people who went through the so-called elite machine, preparing machine, like Ivy League in the United States or Cambridge or Oxford, you know, in UK, and you see the result. And the political system is utterly corrupt, and those people, they really don't have any professions, they don't have any specific professional skills, and as the result, they thought they completely bought this stupidest narrative about Russian history, about Russia and Russians. I wrote, you know, I write about this for now more than 10 years nonstop. They believe that, you know what, that once the sanctions are introduced, Russian Putin's regime will collapse. Russians will run with the open arms, you know, to meet the, whatever, you know, Western liberators. I mean, those people are delusional. They have been delusional, well, for good part, well, all of the 21st century and a good part of the 20th century. As I already stated, when you literally imagine your history, including military history, which is absolutely not true, you will begin to believe this, you know, and then they suddenly face the reality of real economy, real military, real political systems, which actually are functional. So, and as a result, I mean, you have to be a complete moron to believe that late Alexei Navalny could have been the president of Russia. You have to be completely detached from the, you know, real world. And as I already stated, and I'm on record, you can quote me on this, Russian study field in the United States is the wasteland filled with the pseudo-academic shysters who are basically telling the American elites what they want to hear. How great they are and how bad Russians are, because, you know, Russians are those, how to put it, you know, Stalinist, you know, totalitarian people, it's Mordor. So there you go. And as a result, we have the result what we have today.
When you look at Navalny, we see everything that Putin has been doing all these years for uniting Russia, for bringing all of these people together from various religions, ethnicities, all feel Russians right now. He was the opposite way. He was trying to undo everything Putin was trying to do, and he did during these years. How do you find the case of Navalny, and how did you see this repercussion of his death in the Western media?
Well, the point is nobody cares about the Western Russia anymore. Just simple as that. Nobody gives a whatever, you know what I was about to say. So except for the marginal, you know, marginalized, you know, urban, uber liberal creative class, the rest of the people don't care anymore, you know. So for starters, Russians never lived as well as they do today. Never in history. They just enjoying good life. And even despite the war, it's improving. And secondly, I mean, look at the figure of Navalny, who is obviously, everybody understood it just in the open. Everybody were discussing it, that he's nothing more than the, some asset of the CIA or maybe MI6. And that tells you how incompetent they are. So, well, they're obviously trying now to engage with the communists. So there we go. Who would ever thought that? So, and they just incompetent. That's the whole thing. They don't understand Russia. They may read books on Russian history, but they don't understand. The Russia which they see is the Russia which Solzhenitsyn described to them. You know, this Mordor, Gulag, and the fact that Russia is politically freer than the United States. Culturally, it is certainly freer, and it certainly doesn't do the things which West is doing to completely annihilate its own civilization. And as the result, they fail. They will fail again. They just don't get it, you know, and This is a systemic problem. It starts from the basically public school, then projects itself into the institutions of the higher learning, higher education. And as I already stated, that comes back, it will always come back to the basically square one. The Russian study field in the United States or in the West, it's garbage. It's absolute garbage. It was the basically bunch of the sinecures to be abused by all kinds of the shysters, you know? So, and when you don't have the situational awareness, what is going to happen? You're going to lose. In some sense, for Russians, it's actually very, profitable. For example, I could be actually dangerous for Russia because, you know what, I'm trying to break this delusion, because Russians wouldn't mind having these delusional people in the West who are pretty much occupy most of the political positions, positions of political power. So if they want to continue to live in this idiotic, parallel universe, sure, let them, you know. As long as there is no attempts to unleash nuclear war, for that Russia has deterrent. So there you go. Who cares? You know, it's the problem of the West, and the West is doing well. It's doing a swell job of killing itself.
We've seen that Biden was calling Putin with some bad words, and Anthony Blinken in his meeting with Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, said that he sees no conditions for peace talks. With all that said, is it going to change the Russian mind? Because Putin, in his interview, was talking about negotiations. He was talking about cooperation with this administration in office. Is that possible?
No, not with these people. No, absolutely not. So, and that's the point, you know, behavior of Biden, Blinken, or Sullivan, these are highly uncultured people. We know that Mr. Sullivan was communicating and still communicates with Mr. Ushakov, its deputy foreign minister of Russia. Whatever they talk about, but you cannot negotiate with Obama. And obviously, we understand that Obama is basically the driving force behind Biden administration. So, and you cannot communicate with those people. First, they, as I already stated, they are illiterate and they are highly uncultured. So in this particular case, they do not even understand the fundamentals of the statecraft, and they are empty suits in this respect because they are all ideologues. And their desperation, for example, like Biden calling Mr. Putin crazy son of a bitch, I mean, it's like, you know what, can you be offended by the five-year-old child? You can't. I mean, they're kids, okay? And that's the whole point. This is the thing which many people still don't get it. The disparity between, for example, current political class in Russia and political class in the West, in the United States, it is so gigantic. It cannot be bridged with these people. Some new generation of the American politicians should come on stage and, you know, present the United States in some different light. And then maybe, but again, many people also misunderstand what Putin, Lavrov, Medvedev say. They always say this. They do not offer negotiations. They always say that Russia is open for negotiations. But each time they will procrastinate and will delay coming to Russia, the worse and worse it will become for the combined West. Mr. Lavrov, last week, he stated that there is still very little time left to save something of Ukraine. I mean, the more it goes, there will be no Ukraine. And then, of course, again, we already know the combined West, the United States, they will be dictated the conditions of the surrender. The only issue for the United States now diplomatically is negotiate how severe those conditions will be, period. There is no such thing as West can win. It cannot. That cannot win militarily, economically, what have you. And so as a result, they do what the only thing they can do. They do PR, public relations stunts. Those, as I already stated, American journalists, average American journalists are not journalists. They are propagandists. American military, after I read the latest their document, it's just I'm scratching my head. Evidently, they learn nothing. And then same goes for the political class. They cannot govern. They don't have skills. They don't have education for that. As the result, yeah, you cannot communicate with them on equal basis when you apply their basically skills, which are recognized by the other, of statesmanship. So, and as the result, as I already stated, Mr. Biden can call Putin whatever he wants, or, you know, they will try to, you know, try to impress on Russia something. You cannot be insulted by the five-year-old child because it's a child. Here we have the who have zero competences in across the whole board of the governance skills, and simple as that.
Zelensky said that the number of casualties on the part of Ukrainian was 33,000, which was so shocking. And even CNN was saying that no, it's beyond that, it's 71,000. When it comes to the casualties on the part of Ukrainian, in your opinion, what would be the most accurate number?
Mr. Shoigu, 3 days ago, he gave the updated data on the casualties of armed forces of Ukraine. He gave it 444,000 KIAs and MIAs and wounded. So you can easily multiply this number by two. The reason I'm saying that, because Russians probably do this, because these are the only things which Russians can confirm. They literally can go in and say, oh, I have this body, or I know that this is, a wounded. What happens in the tactical rear, where Russians absolutely wreaking havoc with that. It's the same as what's the case with the this third assault brigade, which is essentially Azov, in which was attacked by the Iskander missiles at Selidova. Russians don't even count numbers there because they cannot objectively control them. They see some corpses because obviously the drone flies in, gives the targeting and gives the post-battle assessment. But again, how you can calculate that? And then, so when you go basically on these numbers and you can easily extrapolate, we're looking at least at, you know, at least of the 500,000 killed, and probably the same number or even more. Usually it's 1 to 2 or 1 to 3. So we altogether are looking at something when the numbers will be presented at 1.5 million, I would say, which will be killed and missing and wounded in action. Maybe more by the number of the graveyards, essentially cemeteries. It's appalling. You will look at those. There are hundreds of them. And there are, I mean, when you look at them, some of them just go beyond the horizon. And they're just all those people killed there, the armed forces of Ukraine personnel. So we're looking at horrifying numbers. And that is the, when even CNN laughs at it, you know, that means something.
Some reports from the Ukrainian intelligence that they're fearing an attempt of overthrowing Zelensky in the spring. Is that related to this conflict between Zelensky and Zelensky?
It's kind of the internal, they are like those cockroaches or scorpions in the can, you know, in the jar, which try to kill each other. So who cares, you know, if Zelensky will be overthrown or some other general will be killed. And I mean, it changes nothing in terms of the outcome. And it doesn't matter that Zelensky is probably now constantly high on cocaine, you know, and he definitely doesn't come across as a person in the normal state of mind. And even his appearance tells you that. So they kill or remove Zelensky, doesn't matter who comes in. There are certain conditions which will be either fulfilled or Ukraine will cease to exist completely. Simple as that.
Macron is changing his attitude toward this conflict and he's talking about sending troops, NATO troops, to Ukraine. This is the guy who was trying to make some sort of negotiations between the West and Russia when this conflict started and during this conflict. And he's changing Totally. What's the reason behind this, and what's the strategy, in your opinion, on the part of Macron?
Part of the strategy on the part of Macron, that listen, this is French. They made the bed, let them sleep in it. You know, they voted for the guy. So is the fact that he's obviously his numbers are dismal in terms of approval numbers, and Western politicians being very, as I already stated, very uncultured, and most of them are wusses, actually. If you look at the modern crop of the politicians, they are, you know, the guys who never held a real job in their life, and they, you know, lived the life of luxury. They're spoiled brats, petulant children, and the only thing they know that if you want to raise some numbers is, oh, let's, you know, come across as tough, you know, and so how are you going to make yourself look tough? Let's bark at Russia. It's just Chihuahua barking at the elephant, you know. And so when he offered troops to Russia, obviously their reaction followed immediately from all countries of NATO, United States, United Kingdom, that we're not sending any troops. At least they, now you have to understand also that French somehow, they have their own very specific, very French view of the world around them. Leo Tolstoy beautifully described it in The War and Peace. They think that they are so just absolutely irresistible and wonderful people. So they suddenly, of course, when their those killed French volunteers, quote unquote, which I essentially have been the officers of the French intelligence, have been killed by Russians, they still finding the way to kind of justify it, you know, that, oh yeah, you know what, let's send troops or something like this. So that's totally irrational behavior, and it is done for numbers of reasons, which are, of course, internal political dynamics, trying to be look tough, and then, you know what, they are not rational people really anymore. So, and the attempts of Macron to start negotiating at the start of the special military operation, yeah, it's all PR too, you know. So he wasn't doing this in good faith, so all PR. All PR, the whole situation around the combined West right now is nothing than PR.
They're talking about using the frozen Russian assets to send arms to Ukraine. If they do this, what would be the reaction on the part of Russians?
Well, Russia obviously will expropriate. It has some assets. Russians most likely will not touch the private property of even such French organization like Auchan. It's a very famous network of the large stores, you know, something like a kind of European Walmart. It operates in Russia. They said, no, screw you people. We're not going anywhere, you know, which is, I'm applauding them for being, you know, it's their market, sure. But Russia has enough assets which it can expropriate. But the point is, if they do that, it's over for the West. It's already over for the West anyway. It just they will accelerate their collapse of their imagery. And because if you steal somebody's assets, guess how other countries will look at that? So they will look at that with their, you know, nobody will want to do their business with the West anymore. And it's already happening. It's just that it will accelerate and it will basically proceed with much higher speed.
CIA Director William Burns was in Kiev. And in your opinion, what was the reason behind this trip? And what was the necessity of being there personally?
My thought would be that, first, there is some, again, as I already stated, internal dynamics in Ukraine is such that United States is really involved directly in the basically control of the of Kiev regime. Ukraine essentially is now the part of the American operation. And so visits of by Victoria Nuland or William Burns, it is primarily visits for the settling some things inside there, what essentially becoming now, you know, well, turmoil, let's put it this way, politely, in reality, disintegration of the whole regime. And there are signs that regime in Kyiv disintegrates. And so they are going there, you know, as caretakers, you know, they try to settle it and do some kind, whatever they try to do, you know, stitch together whatever is, you know, going at the seams. And that's the only way I can explain it. There's no operational military intelligence sense of Burns going there other than political, you know, mingling and doing political thing.
Do you see the Biden administration successful in their attempts to send more aids to Ukraine? Because the Republicans are not willing to do that.
I think it's possible that these funds will be, sent or unblocked, so to speak, at the level or in Congress. It's not going to change much, really. I mean, first, the question is, this money, if they go to Ukraine, these are primarily for keeping Ukrainian apparatus, state apparatus running, like paying pensions, paying salaries of the bureaucrats, you know, things of this nature. There is no real serious economic activity in Ukraine anymore because it's half of the Ukrainian budget is essentially based on the donations and support from the European Union and United States. So, and in terms of weapons, the United States simply doesn't produce enough weapons for itself. Forget about, you know, so if they want to start to going deep into their non-untouchable stocks, sure, they can do that. But then again, United States will have pretty much no weapons left.
I asked this question, the previous question, because Wall Street Journal reported that no one wants Ukraine to win. There is an article in Wall Street Journal. And we had a German journalist, Julian Röpke. He says that Europeans send less than 10% of their military budget and they're putting all the blame on the United States. It seems that they're thinking that they did nothing for Ukraine in the eyes of these people in Wall Street Journal, in Bill, in this German journalist. Is that the reality?
No, Germany is a major basically supporter and supplier for Ukraine. So it's all garbage, obviously. It's all about internal fighting right now. You know, there are cracks in the European Union now, and Europeans, I mean, the whole political landscape right now in the United States and in Europe is basically the landscape which is ready as this volcano, you know, super volcano in Wyoming, you know, Yellowstone, to explode. And we see those signs. We are looking already in Europe going completely into the tyranny. There is no democracy. That is all garbage, you know, it's all propaganda. So in the United States, and now you have all those factions, political factions, fighting between each other, because obviously, as I stated from the get-go, when it all started, that it's over. You know, the moment Russian troops entered 2 years ago, at the February 24, the territory of the Donbass republics, it was over for the West as we know it. It's just a matter of how it will be formalized in terms of some kind of settlement. I don't know, you know, how it's going to look down the road. They may continue to, do something about Ukraine, but it's over, you know, and many people understand that. And some understand it on the, how to put it, intellectually, you know, others understand this or, you know, sense that purely on emotional level. And considering the pathetic level of, for example, American journalism, when you look at these people on, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they are clowns, basically. You know, these people, again, have no idea what they're dealing with. You can feel that they have to also somehow express their frustrations within the political system, which is completely ceased to function. American political system is on the verge of completely ceasing. In Europe, it's happening right now. And again, as I spoke recently, I don't remember with who, that even the if you look at the farmers' protests, it's just the start, you know? And so they will blame each other. You know, Wall Street Journal will blame somebody in Germany. Germans will blame somebody elsewhere. So let them, you know, it's the process, okay? The dam has been, you know, breached, so to speak. And it will just only increase.
When you look at the Russian strategy right now, do you think that in their mind, they're thinking of crossing the Dnieper River, or they're not interested in doing that?
There are a number of ways of handling this. They certainly can. And even Medvedev said that, well, if it comes down to Kyiv, so be it. We'll go to Kyiv. It all depends. And again, this is the thing which many people do not understand. Russians fight the wars for the political ends, which are very well defined. And as I already stated, if you go back to the December 2021 and so-called Russian ultimatum, everything is in there. Everything is written there. Another matter that the more it drags out, the worse it will be, as I already stated, for the combined West. And again, so at some point of time, if it comes down to it, Ukraine will simply cease to exist. You know. So, but Russia will not allow hostile Ukraine. And now it's not going to be even neutral. The Kyiv regime will be removed. And then if Ukraine will be preserved as some kind of the geographic locality, it will be controlled from Moscow. But again, depending on the behavior of the Western political class, Ukraine may cease to exist altogether.
In this preparation of the British army, their submarine has failed to launch a missile. If that's the quality that they're having right now, and you look at this conflict in the Red Sea between Houthis and the United States and United Kingdom, how do Russians and Chinese perceive this conflict? How well they were performing in the Red Sea, in your opinion?
Horribly. A German frigate almost shut down MQ-9 Reaper today. And both missiles, though, failed. You know, so it's a comedy, really. It's how can I say? It is. Yeah, I know. It took the whole situation with S special military operation and Houthis to really expose the West as a paper tiger, and it is. And we already saw itself, you know, what it's a French. I mean, they had like 200 Leclerc tanks. Half of them are not operational. So, yeah, sure, let them send troops to Russia. And when they, so when you see this and things fail, obviously, make no mistake. I do not want to overplay it because obviously things do break down. It's complex technology. And so Russians also have some things malfunction and things of this nature. Remarkably, in case of Vanguard submarine of the Royal Navy, it is altogether strange because usually Trident D2, D5 is a fairly good missile. You know, it's fairly reliable. It has a good record of launches. Why they have the issue with it? They had the issue with 2016. It failed, and now it failed there. I don't know what's going on there, but obviously we can say that in many respects we're looking at the not just technical readiness, which is evidently not very high. We're looking at more systemic approach in terms of the procurement strategies. And Western weapons, if you look at, for example, Western air defenses, and I'm not talking about Patriots, which have been, you know, killed periodically on in Ukraine. We can talk about NASAMS. We can talk about other types of air defense systems. They simply are not that effective. And it's like you look at this, man, oh my gosh, you know, this is, they spend trillions of dollars on all that and it doesn't work. You know, so what can I say? It is what it is.
For those people who are watching this performance of the British Navy and they compare it with the other countries in Europe, in German, with Italians or French, are they better than the United Kingdom? Are they at the same level? How do you see this?
French have totally in the first. You have to understand, in terms of strategic missiles, Royal Navy has four submarines, strategic missile submarines, Vanguard class, and I believe they can put to sea only one at this stage, and even that they have 16 silos, so to speak, you know, but they go on the combat patrol with only four Trident D5 missiles out of possible 16. So it's really deterrent, but it's really not a real deterrent. Real deterrent is French. Marine Nationale, they have the four Triumphant class strategic missile submarines, all of them carrying 16 missiles. and I believe two of them are on patrol every given moment of time. And that nuclear deterrent is completely independent of the United States. So if they decide, for some unknown reason to me, to launch, they can do it completely on their own volition. And France produces those missiles, and it maintains this small but capable, nuclear-powered strategic missile submarines. The rest of it, not really serious, So
recently, Zelensky had an interview with Fox News. In this interview, Zelensky says that nobody needs Avdiivka. If that's the case, why they were sacrificing too much in Avdiivka? What was the importance of Avdiivka for Ukrainians?
Russians have the proverb, logic is the Moscow's science. I mean, like meaning Russian science, which Ukrainians do not accept. Yeah, Bakhmut also wasn't important. Mariupol wasn't important. So the next thing, Kyiv probably also will not be important. So this is how they think, because basically, if you look attentively what is happening in Ukraine, it's a madness, actually. I never saw anything like this. The nation to be brainwashed to such a degree that it's just absolutely, it's incredible. It's absolutely, it's on the level of the Nazi Germany, brainwashed to the point of supporting wars and things like that. This is the level, but it's multiplied even more so by the modern social media. And it's unbelievable. So they will lose. Now the Russians obviously advancing very well on Avdiivka access, in Donetsk, but they're also moving towards Kupiansk. Guess what? Once Kupiansk fall, it's not going to be again important. We killed 20,000 people there of our own. We sacrificed them, but it's not important. This is how they think, literally, because as I already stated, when you look at them, they do nothing but PR. Those people do not have statesmanship capabilities. All of them, from Washington to Kyiv, pretty much, and everything about PR, money, corruption, or, just grift. And it's unbelievable. And guess what? Regular Ukrainians die in tens of thousands every month. It's just, wow. What can I say?
He said that Ukraine has no plan B, no backup plan. At the end of the day, who's going to force them to have a backup plan? It would be Russia or the United States.
It doesn't matter if they have backup plan. They have chance right now. Call Kremlin and say, listen, we're done. Let's talk. And then, of course, they will be dictated their surrender conditions. And if they don't follow, Russians will continue to do what they're doing now. And it doesn't matter if the United States wants it or European Union. Nobody cares. So if you have to understand, they cannot talk to Moscow. You know why? Because it is prohibited by the Ukrainian constitution. That's the point. That's the funniest thing. It was so, then it will continue, until it's all over. And there you go. So it doesn't matter if they have plan B even, So, and Zelensky knows the moment he lifts the receiver and calls Kremlin, he will be dead. So it is the, glass jar in which bunch of the scorpions, from large ones like United States to small ones, just run around each other, try to, kind of sting each other. So there you go, let them. What can I say? And Russians know that.
At the border of Ukraine and Poland, they're having some problems. The Polish farmers are not happy with the situation, and Ukraine doesn't have access to the Black Sea. It seems that the Zelensky administration is gradually destroying Ukraine, because if Poland doesn't agree with them right now, how after this conflict they're going to let Ukrainians use their border?
No, it's decided already now, and when you have the Polish farmers driving on the tractor with saying Putin come sort it out between Ukraine and Brussels and carry the Soviet flag, that tells you a lot, and then of course they threw away 160 tons of Ukrainian grain in one of the, it's a terrifying picture, really, when you look at that, those carts and grain on the ground. And so if some people say, oh, it's GMO, it doesn't matter. It could have gone to actually, you know, people who really need it, you know. GMO or not GMO, who cares, you know, if you can fight hunger in the world and things of this nature. But it's one thing to make their political statements and do their political theater, like hugging each other, saying, oh, yeah, you know, like we're friends. No, they're not friends. Poland has its own very legitimate, you know, economic interests, and Ukraine is, you know, crossing them. And guess what? The reaction immediately follows. And it's quite natural reaction. You cannot blame Polish farmers for that. It's their livelihood. People need to work. They need to sell their product. They need to make their living from that. And then suddenly you have these guys who have been promised all kinds of the, you know, hugs and kisses in the West, just doing things which haven't been supposed to be done. And the reaction follows immediately. So Polish farmers in this case are absolutely correct. But for now, it is primarily economic. There's some political calls there, but it's economic kind of type of pricing, so to speak. And it's legitimate. It has the reasons for that. So, and Ukraine, well, they are destroyed, essentially. So there's very little which they can do now.
Do you see this type of reaction on the part of the public opinion in Poland coming to the political parties in Poland?
Polish elites hate Russia. They hate it with all their guts. I mean, they just abhor Russians. Poles, on average, however, they're not as aggressive. But the problem is, again, we know the game. Again, anybody who by now use the word democracy, you know, it's going to be laughed at, okay? Everything already have been bought and lined up that only right people get elected. And so even if the Poles will try to elect somebody else, it's not going to do much good. So their Polish elites will continue to hate Russia and do everything stupid about it. But essentially, economic reality should, so to speak, you know, bite them in the butt, and it's already beginning, and they will have to adjust their policies simply for the reason of survival. Do not forget, when Macron stupidly and laughably dropped this proposition to send troops to Russia, guess what? Poland was one of the first who said, you know what? Go screw yourself. We're not sending anybody. So there you go. So no matter how they hate Russians, no matter how they supported Ukraine and send indeed those volunteers, so to speak, nobody wants to die. Everybody wants to live. And there are certain red lines nobody wants to cross.
When you talk about the Polish elites, like Sikorski, whose wife is a neocon, do you talk about those people who are connected to neocons?
Radek Sikorski is a psycho. I mean, he absolutely delusional, as his wife, who is the, she doesn't have normal education. She's a neocon. She's falsifier of the history. So these are the type of the people. And again, do not forget, their hatred of Russia comes, for example, if you look at Poland per se as state, Poland hates Russians because basically it was Russia which prevented Poland from becoming their, you know, empire itself. From Morze to Morze, as they say, from sea to sea. So Russians kind of are hated there by them because, yeah, these were Russians who not only prevented them, they actually incorporated them into Russian Empire. Don't forget, Poland was part of Russia. So, but in neocons, it's a racial hatred also. It's hatred for perceived pogroms, you know, which they carry on. So they hate Russians on the ethnic, religious, ethnic, and racial reasons. So it is profound, and you cannot fix it. So, and this is what is being channeled through those people into Poland. So it's kind of amplification of what already existed there. So, yeah, when you talk about neocons, most of them are genocidal maniacs. They would love to see Russian people just completely die out and just disappear. So this is how they are.
Do you remember when this war started, there was a debate between Sikorsky and Michael McFaul and John Mearsheimer. They were debating on the issue of the war in Ukraine, in which Sikorsky was picturing Russia in that debate. He was picturing the Soviet Union. And I don't know why he was doing that, because Russia today has nothing to do with the Soviet Union.
Well, first, let's start with Michael McFaul, who is known in the United States as the foremost authority on Russia. The guy's a complete idiot, and I mean it. So same goes for Sikorsky. When I say they are uneducated, you look at the thesis they write. It's, it's the level of the freshman year in some, university. It used to be in the 80s and 70s. These people are absolute morons. Michael McFaul, by the way, for being a Russian specialist, he doesn't even speak decent Russian. So is Sikorsky. He was in Afghanistan supporting Mujahideen. These are fanatics. And again, add here that they're fanatics who are very uncultured. And how to put it politely, these guys are impotent in terms of any kind of the serious academic or statesmanship skills. This is the way it is. You can take, for example, Walter Model of Wehrmacht, okay, who was a fanatical Nazi, okay? But guess what? The guy was a genius military leader. He was really damn good, you know? So this is not the case with modern Western elites. There are no Walter Models there, mostly Michael McFaul and Sikorsky, propagandist ideologues who have no real skills in anything. And again, as I already stated, they are uncultured. So they're simply fanatics who have no background.
Sergei Lavrov, he was talking about the UN Security Council, and he said that they're supporting Africa, Asia, and Latin America to have representatives in this council. If we were going to have some sort of balance in the international relations, that would be the case that Lavrov was talking about.
Obviously, there is no doubt that the representatives of those very large geographic and economic and demographic clusters should be present in the Security Council. As the problem, of course, is the fact that United Nations itself as the organization completely compromised. And so Lavrov is doing the thing which any diplomat, a real diplomat, will do. He tries to save some kind of the platform or exchange structure. But I don't see how United Nations will survive in the form it exists today, especially since it is located in the United States. And there's always the problems with the visas and access of diplomats to the United Nations. So essentially, I think so. It either will be somehow die out, it will die out probably, or will be abandoned, and some new structure, diplomatic structure and global structure will emerge. Could be on the base of BRICS or could be something else. I don't know. But Lavrov is doing his best to save, United Nations Charter. And then, of course, United Nations, which is utterly corrupt. We know it is corrupt.
The other institution that brings all these countries together is G20. How do you see the G20?
Well, it's just G20 is economic powers of modernity talking to each other. But it is nothing than a conversation club, essentially. It doesn't have any serious, so to speak, charter mutually agreed by participants, as it was with the UN Charter and creation of the United Nations, because obviously it was created by the victors in the World War II. So G20, it's just probably going to be the G20. People will get together, talk about, economic, political issues, and probably will stay the same way. I don't know.